This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Natural gas and fracking are divisive issues here in Pennsylvania, home to large swaths of the Marcellus Shale. There have been fights about taxing the gas, about zoning rights, environmental impacts, regulation, truck traffic, and at the same time, it has helped the state's economy. Natural gas and fracking have also helped to make the country more energy independent. Some are even floating the idea that the U.S. could sell gas to Europe to help defuse the crisis in Ukraine, which depends on Russia for fuel. Our guest, Russell Gold, explores the history of fracking in the United States and the complex issues the practice raises in his new book, and it's called The Boom, and it's subtitled How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. And our guest, Russell Gold, is senior energy reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and he's based in Texas, joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you back, I guess, home here in Philadelphia. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. And I like where your book begins. It's very personal. Your family has land up in Sullivan County up in Pennsylvania, where there's been a lot of fracking, a lot of Marcellus Shale exploration. And your family was trying to decide, you know, what should we do? They were approached by Chesapeake Energy, offered $400,000 plus royalties to put some wells on their land.
Right. No, I have been covering oil and gas and fracking for the Wall Street Journal for years at that point when the offer came. And, you know, this was going on in Texas and it was taking root in Arkansas and Louisiana. And then all of a sudden, it's spread so quickly into Pennsylvania as well. And what had been part of my job suddenly became personal. And the question really became, okay, well, do we do this? Do we allow oil and gas, or in this case, gas exploration on our property? And this is property they own with some friends. And, you know, this was land that was in between all of the farms. You know, it was the land that none of the farmers wanted. It was not meant to be developed. It's too rocky and woody. And, you know, it was just something for city kids to run around in, get a little sense of nature, cheap vacations. And all of a sudden, we had to really confront this question, do we allow in oil and gas exploration? It was a tough question.
And your parents decided to do it, although with a great deal of reluctance, I should say.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my father drove around, talked to the neighbors, and heard, frankly, that it was all going to happen anyway. Even if they didn't lease that 100 acres, all of the farmers around them had leased it. They were going to get rigs. They were going to get trucks. Fracking is industrialization. Wow. It is an industrialization of a rural area. At least as it played out in Pennsylvania. And so, you know, I suggested to them, look, if you're going to do this, you have the upper hand until you sign that piece of paper. And so figure out, where do you want the pad to be? Do you want it, you know, right in your backyard, literally, or do you want it as far away as possible? And I tried to, you know, talk them through, figure out how you can do this right. Because all of us, we use tremendous amounts of energy. Americans use more energy per person than any other country in the world. So if we're going to use this energy, let's try to figure out how we can participate in producing it and to do it in a way that we can be okay with. And that's really the challenge we're all facing right now.
And I'm just curious about how it has worked out for them, whether there have been leaks. Is it smelly? I know from your description, there's a well pad a couple hundred yards from the house.
It's actually a little further than that. It's, okay. You don't even see it from the house. It's sort of right as you turn off the two-lane road. Good news and bad news. Okay, let's start with the good news. The good news is no water leaks, as far as you can tell. You don't get a sense of the air is fine to breathe. I mean, when you go in and drill and then frack, that's a really industrial activity, but it doesn't last forever. And then what's left over is this 5-foot tall wellhead, and it's, you know, it's just a flattened piece of earth with a fence around it. So that's the good news. The bad news is that there was on the backside of the property is a small creek, and they were drilling a gathering line. This is a pipeline that's used to connect all the different wells and bring up the gas. And as they were putting it under the creek, there was a barite leak. This is sort of a type of mineral that's a slurry that's used to drill. And it got into the creek, and there was a small fish kill. And look, that happens. But what really disturbed me was that the state of Pennsylvania didn't fine anyone. They didn't have an investigation. It just sort of was, well, this is a cost of doing business, I suppose. And that was disturbing. And then the other thing that happened was is that it is very important to make sure these wells are built right, to that if you're going to drill and build a well that's going to be there for decades, you have to do it right. Because if you don't, there are going to be problems down the road. So I had talked to my father and said, okay, this is what you need to ask to make sure. And he was unable, you know, several phone calls going around in circles, getting, you know, sent, we'll talk to someone in Williamsport, no, then talk to someone in Oklahoma City, talk here, talk there. Couldn't get any sense as to how they tested the well to make sure it was built right. And that also concerned me a lot. So some good news, but also some firsthand experience with some of the problems here.
I do want to talk more broadly about natural gas and fracking, but you also talk about Sullivan County. A bit of a divide there. The people that have lived there for generations seem to be more willing to have fracking on their land. The newcomers, not so much.
Absolutely. I mean, that's sort of what I found anecdotally driving around Sullivan County. And just a couple weeks ago, I was talking to a PhD candidate at Princeton who wrote his dissertation and actually did an academic study of this in New York. And lo and behold, what did he find is that in the richer parts of New York State, where mostly you have newcomers, people moving out from New York City, they don't want fracking. But in the poorer parts, where there's still a lot of agricultural activity, they're in favor of fracking. And so that the divide that I found in Sullivan County, it seems to be happening all over the Marcellus region.
In fact, I mean, your parents, again, they were offered $400,000. I mean, that's a lot of money. It doesn't matter, you know, how rich you are.
Absolutely.
That is a lot of money.
Right. And, you know, it was split between, I think, about five different couples, but still, even that, it is a lot of money. And that, you know, when you know, it's one thing to offer this to Philadelphians who, you know, are not living off the land, but if you think about a lot of these dairy farmers who are hanging in there, farmers who are growing alfalfa and corn, having trouble making their payments, and all of a sudden the companies are coming around and saying $10,000 an acre to sign up, it is hard to turn that down. And you have these, I write in my book about this one couple that I met in Sullivan County. They wanted to sign a lease. They had signed leases in the past. And Chesapeake came out and said, well, we're going to put the well right here. And they sort of said, well, wait a second. That's right on top of our water. We're a dairy farm. We need that spring has been giving us fresh, clean water for 50 years. Why don't you move it 200 yards over there? And they ended up having a fight in federal court over the location of the well. Mm. And it just really drove home to me just the difference of perspectives, because from Chesapeake's point of view, where they wanted to put the well made absolutely perfect sense. They were thinking about the rock and where the stress fractures are and the underground geology. And the landowners, the farmers, were thinking about, well, where's our fresh water? Where's our best soil? Where's our worst soil? It was cultures that just could not speak to each other and speak the same language.
I'm sure that someone who heard you say, let's do it right, is saying, you can't. You cannot do it right with fracking and natural gas. I mean, maybe by saying doing it right, meaning doing it better than we are doing it now?
No, absolutely. That's one of the things I talk a lot about and write about in the book is how can you do this better? Because if we're going to be a fossil fuel society, and we are, and we're going to be for a couple decades to come at least, I think it's incumbent upon us to ask the question, how can we do it better? How can we make sure that in 20 years, when we look back at this energy boom, no energy booms last forever, that we look back with relief and not regret. We look back and say, oh, we use this to transform our energy landscape into something what we want. We use this to create jobs. We use this to enrich people. We use this to, you know, transition to renewable energy and not look back and say, wow, we had this great economic boom, and what do we have to show for it? We've got a couple aquifers that need to be cleaned up, et cetera. That's what I mean by doing it right.
Well, I'm thinking about, you know, West Virginia, places where there's been coal mining and strip mining and all the things that were done to mountaintops. I mean, there's a legacy here to be very careful and cautious about.
No, there's no question about it. I mean, one of the things that fascinated me when I was reporting in north central Pennsylvania, which, you know, where the land was turned out to be one of the best parts of the Marcellus to drill, was that, you know, I'd always gone out there and said, this is beautiful land, all these beautiful trees. Well, all the trees have been cut down. This was all second growth for tanneries back in the 19th century. And then the coal mines came and, you know, there's acid runoff and there are streams that are still need to be cleaned up. And I ended up quoting a county commissioner up there who basically said, you know, look, if you know, we messed up the timber, we messed up the coal, if we mess up gas, really, what do we have to show for ourselves? Mm-hmm. So, look, you can be pessimistic and say we don't have a good track record here. And you know, that certainly is one possible outcome. But we have an opportunity right now. And I think one of the things that as a Wall Street Journal energy reporter, I see crystal clear is just what a change the energy landscape is going through right now. How things that were settled and conventional wisdom 2 years ago are completely up for grabs right now. This is a huge opportunity. And the whole system is going to change. It is changing. So what we really need to do is sort of engage and try to figure out, okay, what do we want it to look like in 10 years? What do we want it to look like in 20 years?
In fact, you say we have to address this issue of methane leaks, that's really, if there is a perhaps number one problem, that is certainly near the top.
Well, no, yeah, absolutely.
Or maybe the top?
Well, it depends who you talk to, but it's certainly one of the top issues. Earthquakes, that's a big issue too. And let's face it, build a bad well and you contaminate aquifer, that's a huge issue. But methane leakage is a big issue because natural gas has been, as more and more natural gas is produced, it's being used to generate electricity and coal plants are being shut down. That is a huge positive for climate change. The United States greenhouse gas emissions have gone down significantly.
Because of this?
Because of that. Absolutely. I mean, there's sort of two big issues. One, we're driving more fuel-efficient cars. That's a positive. But also, we're shutting down coal plants and burning natural gas. And the air is cleaner, too. New York City's air is cleaner than it's been in decades because of the natural gas. But natural gas is basically methane, 90% or more or less. If that leaks out, it itself is a huge and potent greenhouse gas. So there has to be – so that really reduces the benefit, the climate change benefit. And so you absolutely have to focus on that issue. And you look at a place like Colorado, which is really tackling that right now, trying to figure out ways so that the wellhead – during the construction, during the fracking, that you don't leak out methane, that you capture at the wellhead. The people I talk to say right now natural gas is better for the environment than coal, and it can get a lot better than that if you fix some rather large leaks. But, you know, it's a problem. I mean, it's an issue because you've got pipelines going everywhere. There's a lot of plumbing that's going to need to happen.
And we're almost having a break here, but are we talking literally about just better cementing around wells? Would that take care of a methane problem? Or is it – it's just there's so many joints that have to be
– The cementing plugged? Is underground. The cementing is underground to make sure that the wells are well built. That's really more of a water leakage issue. On methane, you know, it's really up at the surface before it goes into the pipeline. You have all these valves and gauges, and that's where you have a lot of the leakage going on.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Russell Gold. He's senior energy reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's based in Texas. In fact, received a Gerald Loeb Award and was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill of a couple of years ago. And we're talking about his new book. It's called The Boom, and it's subtitled How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. Much more to talk about after this short break. We also want to open the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Simpson Meadows, a retirement community in Downingtown, PA, in Chester County. Managed by Simpson Senior Services, a nonprofit with a long-standing tradition of care. Simpson Meadows provides personal care for senior adults, along with memory care, respite, and independent living. A specially designed personal care neighborhood staffed with licensed nurses provides assistance with daily tasks to help residents remain as independent as possible. More at simpsonmeadows.org.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Treasures from Korea, Arts and Culture of the Joseon Dynasty, the first full-scale American exhibition devoted to the art of the Joseon Dynasty. 500 years of tradition, ritual, and honor from a line of 27 kings that shaped contemporary Korea. The exhibition brings many Korean national treasures to the U.S. for the first time. On view through May 26th. Tickets and info at philamuseum.org.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive-dba.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Over the past decade or so, hydraulic fracturing or fracking has expanded across Pennsylvania after the discovery of natural gas in the Marcellus Shale, also true in other states in this country. And our guest again is Russell Gold, author of a new book called The Boom, How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. One thing, and I've only read about it, and I've seen drawings reconstructions of what fracking looks like.
Right.
But the thought of just putting all that water, forcing it using pressure to get it into rock, adding some chemicals, forcing this natural gas to sort of bubble up out of the rock seems like the most sort of almost like antiquated way to try to get your hands on oil or fossil fuels, I guess. But at the same time, it does raise questions about just the water, what happens to that water, contamination, all of that.
I definitely want to talk about the water, but this is the way it's always been. I mean, you sort of see these Hollywood movie versions where, the well is gushing and people are dancing underneath and Jimmy Stewart or James Dean is, have got oil all over them. That's the exception. The gushers were the exception to the rule. From the earliest days of the oil industry, the engineers, and even before they were engineers, they would smash the rock, blow up the rock.
Torpedoes, right?
The old torpedo, which is basically TNT, used nuclear bombs in the 60s and the 70s to try to incinerate the rock. I mean, this is what the industry does. It's very good at trying to figure out ways to get into the rock and force it to give up its oil and gas. So in that sense, hydraulic fracturing is a sort of a continuation. And it is, it's not particularly high tech. It's a pump with a lot of water and chemicals and just trying to smash into the rock. It's getting a little more high tech, but it wasn't in the beginning. But no, water is a huge, huge issue. And I'm glad you brought that up because you're depending on where you are and which shale, millions of gallons of water are going down. Most of it actually stays there underground. What comes back up has to be cleaned up. Pennsylvania tried to put it through public
A sewer system.
Yeah, a sewer system. That didn't work for obvious reasons. Now they're trucking it from Pennsylvania, spending fossil fuels and diesel, driving it into Ohio where they're putting it in disposal wells, and those disposal wells are causing earthquakes. This is a huge deal. Once again, there are some signs that it could be done better. For instance, there's absolutely no reason why you can't use brackish water to frack, salty water, non-potable water, and the chemistry is being worked out. But right now there's no financial incentive to do that. No one's requiring companies, so they will experiment with it a little, but basically – fresh water is cheap and easy, but using lots of fresh water, actually you use a little bit less than in coal production. Believe it or not, just from the beginning to the end, per kilowatt, you use a little less water for the amount of energy you're producing in gas than in coal, but that seems to get lost in the discussion a lot because people are sort of saying, well, wait a second, we need water. Water is our most precious resource, which it is. Why are we using so much of it to crack open the rock?
Especially when we have drought times and all the sort of changing weather patterns that we have as well.
Absolutely. And down in Texas, where the two areas where there's the most fracking going on right now, South Texas and West Texas, are the exact areas where you have the most extreme drought. And what I see there is, look, there are plenty of important uses for water, industrial uses, agricultural uses, city, municipal uses. What I see is that it's not a fair fight. The oil and gas industry can outbid everyone else for the water. So that's an issue I think it's going to need to be addressed by regulators as to who can get access to the water and how much.
But can we say that there's a connection between fracking and earthquakes?
There is clearly a connection between disposal wells and earthquakes. So when the water comes back up, a lot of the time the water is injected back into the ground. Actually, oil and gas produces so much water along with oil and gas that the number one product really of an oil company is water. That's what they're mostly getting, and then they get a little oil on the side. So a lot of that water is recycled and treated. Most of it is disposed. And what's happening is they're putting it into areas where there are faults and causing earthquakes. Or at the very least, they're causing earthquakes that would otherwise happen, maybe sometime in the next 10,000 years. They're speeding it up. So yes, there's a connection between disposal wells. Whether there's a connection between fracking itself and earthquakes. That's very controversial. Ohio, last month said they thought there might be a connection in eastern Ohio, but that's very controversial. And the seismologists I talked to say they don't see the evidence for that yet.
Do you think the country or even the industry is moving too fast on this issue? I mean, we've been talking about something certainly in Pennsylvania the last, 10 years or so.
Well, it's amazing. The Marcellus Shale, which runs from West Virginia up most of Pennsylvania, the western half of Pennsylvania, up into New York, it has become one of the top two or three gas-producing regions in the world. It recently passed the Yamal Peninsula in Russia, and I think the only one larger than right now is the giant North Field in Qatar in the Middle East. 10 years ago, there was nothing. There was a little legacy production in Pennsylvania, these small little stripper wells. And to go from literally almost a non-existent industry to the largest gas-producing region, second largest in the world, in the span of 9 years, 8 years, it moved incredibly quickly. And a lot of the issues that people are confronting right now, earthquakes, are the wells being built right? Too many trucks on my road, using trains to move oil all across the country. They're all a result of how quickly the industry moved to drill these wells, to lease the land. And what really happened there is that you have, we talked about Chesapeake Energy before. The founder and CEO at the time is a guy named Aubrey McClendon. He is just an incredibly voracious person, one of the more fascinating businessmen to emerge in the last few decades, incredibly voracious, and he led the industry. Basically, he never saw a shale field or a lease that he didn't want to acquire. And you talked to all these other CEOs and said, we would like to have gone slower, but we had to keep up. If we didn't lease quickly, Aubrey would lease in front of us. And once you lease some land, you have 5 years to drill a well. So then they need to, or else it reverts back. So they need to start drilling well. And just things just move so quickly. So one of the things I say in my book is, look, we've been through all that. We've been through the period. The land rush is over. It's time to slow down a little and figure out what mistakes are being made, how to improve this, how to build better wells. All the things we've been talking about. The gas is there. The oil is there. We know it. Let's figure out how to do this in a way that's not destroying communities and that can be compatible.
You raise a question about Aubrey McClendon. You say, is he a huckster, a dynamic salesman, a visionary, a fool? I can't tell.
I actually wrote that in my notebook after I first interviewed him. I think in 2005 or 2006, I was flying from Oklahoma City back to Austin, Texas, where I live. And I wrote that in my notebook. And as I was working on this book, I pulled out my old notebooks and I found this quote, something I'd written contemporaneously. I said, that still stands up. Yeah, it does. Look, when you talk to Aubrey McClendon, he's incredibly smart.
And he's the Chesapeake.
He actually got ran out of Chesapeake, in 2012. He's now reborn himself. Like I say about Aubrey, he's sort of made himself a billionaire three times over, and he's lost it twice so far. But he's back at it in the Utica in Ohio, raised lots of money, drilling lots of wells. He's enthusiastic and people will say he is the best landman of his generation. A landman is someone who goes out and knocks on doors and gets leases signed, gets people to sign over the drilling rights.
And that's Russell Gold. He's the senior energy reporter for the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Boom, How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. We've got a lot of callers that want to join us. Let's get, looks like Bryn from Northeast Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Bryn. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I live up in Tioga County. We're surrounded by well pads, including Shell's first two that go down 12,000 or 13,000 feet to the Utica and Trenton, Black River, all these different names. I'm very glad your guest addressed the methane issue, because certainly that's the biggest issue for the world. The water pollution, the roads, everything else for northern Pennsylvania, that's our bad luck. But the methane is certainly a major issue. But my other concern, which was not addressed yet, is I missed the first part.
That's okay, but go ahead.
Did not hear addressed. Was the complete lack of oversight by the Pennsylvania state government. Just in the New York Times last week, it talked about leadership taken even in Colorado and Texas. Texas is certainly a Rock Rib Republican state, but they're way ahead of Pennsylvania on protections for the side effects.
Sure.
And
you know what,
Brent, operation.
Let's pick up on that because we touched on it just briefly, but let's dig a little bit deeper, Russell.
Yeah, you know, Colorado has been really out in front in terms of coming up with really interesting rules on air emissions and capturing methane. Texas has actually done a very good job on rules to make sure the well integrity, wells are built right. Pennsylvania has its work cut out for it. This was not an industry. You know, you look at both Texas and Colorado, they have a history of oil and gas production. Pennsylvania, frankly, had not been doing very much. They needed to come up to speed very quickly, and there's still a lot of learning. You have a permit instead of a tax on production. So Pennsylvania is sort of struggling right now to try to figure out how to do this. And you know, look, I agree with you. There needs to be better. You cannot have oil, this kind of massive modern oil and gas shale drilling, without a strong, robust regulator system. And one of the things that I said, this is something I learned covering the Deepwater Horizon, the big oil spill in 2010. The federal government, when they went into that, they had one agency that was both the regulator, the watchdog, and the cheerleader trying to promote it. Well, you cannot have that. And a lot of states do. Pennsylvania, I believe, is one of them, Texas, North Dakota, where you have one agency that's trying to encourage this because of the economic development, but also regulate it. No, you got to split those up because otherwise you just can't serve those two masters at the same time.
Bryn, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Just to underscore something you said earlier about how we're really talking about an industry that is moving into where people live. You say that 15 million people live within, what, a mile of a gas well?
Of a new gas well. One that's been drilled since 2000. Yeah, I worked with a colleague on that where we plotted the longitude and latitudes of all the wells across, well, 11 major states, and then used census data. It's really remarkable. The amazing thing, or the fascinating thing to me about this energy boom, is that it's not happening north of the Arctic Circle in Alaska. It's not happening
far away
in
right?
the Gulf of Mexico. It's in people's backyards. This started basically in Fort Worth, Texas, a city of 1.5 million people. It started just north of it, and then the industry realized it went south of it and went right through the city. If you go to Fort Worth right now, there are wells and well pads throughout the city. And so, you know, you see that replicated in Pittsburgh. You know, there are city, and it's not just cities, obviously in rural areas too, where you go and all of a sudden there are well pads every mile or so and pipelines. Mm-hmm. So it's a major industrial activity. And in traveling, you know, the number one complaint I hear from people is trucks. Especially in the rural area. I used to be able to drive to my neighbor down the road. I wouldn't see another car. Now I can't even get out of my driveway because there's just truck after truck after truck. And that's true.
And trucks mean smell and traffic jams and all of that.
Absolutely.
And also development.
And development, but good and bad. You know, getting back to Sullivan County, some of the first new hotels are being built there. You know, people are able to do economic development, but as you often find, you get an increase in drug use. You get an increase in – so it's this is development, and it's catching a lot of people by surprise.
And again, that's Russell Gold, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, author of The Boom, a new book, How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get looks like Jimmy from Binghamton, New York. Sorry, Jimmy. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I live in Binghamton, New York, which is right across the Pennsylvania border.
Yep.
And right now there's a lot of activity trying to keep the moratorium on fracking going on in my area. I have two quick questions for your guest.
Sure.
One regards, in Binghamton, it seems like those most in favor are the landowners, and it seems that fracking would really benefit few at the expense of many, especially in lower-income areas like Binghamton. And then my second concern is the way in which this energy will be used. In my mind, it'd be fine if this energy were used to transition towards a renewable energy economy. However, it seems that it'll just be business as usual, sort of fueling a wasteful fossil fuel economy. And I hope our guests could talk about that.
Those are two good points. Jimmy, let me take the last one, whether natural gas is a bridge fuel or whether it just extends our dependence on natural gas or fossil fuel.
And my answer is yes, right, to both. I mean, it could be either one, really. Clearly, we have discovered a huge amount of fossil fuel right under our feet. and we are drilling it and we are using it. And that is a huge challenge to the environment, to climate change. But on the other hand, when you're talking about renewable energy, and you know, right now, in terms of wind and solar, most states, you know, there's maybe 1 or 2%, and you want to get to 10 and 20 and 30%. So how do you get there? And it turns out natural gas is actually very good for balancing the grid when you have so much intermittent renewables. And so you can certainly see a situation where you have no carbon renewables and low carbon natural gas powering the society, you know, powering this economy. And it's a great vision. It's one I certainly, encourage, and it sounds exciting to me. Whether we get there or not, I don't know, but we certainly can. I mean, Texas the other day got 29% of its electricity from wind.
Really?
29%? Yeah, the Texas grid. I mean, it's huge wind build out, and how do they balance that? With natural gas. So, I mean, you look at Texas, they're starting to do it. It can happen, doesn't mean it's going to happen.
But would it be fair to say that natural gas has made coal very expensive and is essentially sort of putting coal out of business?
Well, it's putting coal out of business in the United States. And so what's happening now, that coal is being sent over to Europe. And so we're suddenly exporting tons of coal to Europe, to places like the Port of Baltimore that we never did before because we're not burning it here. So yeah, energy is a global system, and there are a lot of unintended consequences. But right now we're burning a lot less coal in the United States, and we're exporting it to Europe, which is burning it. And their carbon dioxide emissions are going up. So, that's one reason why there are a lot of people in Europe who want to start fracking, but the pushback there is very strong, mostly because you don't have the land. Getting back to the first question the caller said, you don't have landowners who are benefiting in Europe. Mineral rights are owned by the state.
Very different. What do you make in it? This was in the film Gasland, where there was people that could set their faucet water on fire. It's a scary image, of course.
Absolutely.
It's
kind of the classic image, right? If you think about the Cuyahoga River, back in the 60s or 70s, lighting that on fire. I mean, it's sort of the classic image of environmental destruction, to be able to light water on fire. And just last week in Lynchburg, Virginia, where you had the oil train derail, some of the oil gets into, I think it was the James River there, and what happens? Water's on fire. So, look, it absolutely can happen. There are well-documented cases. Methane gets into an aquifer, and all of a sudden you have methane, and you can light your water on fire because you're bringing up gas. But here's what I can tell you. First of all, there is a lot of gas already in some of these areas. That, you know, it's sort of the old Willie Sutton line. Why do you rob banks? That's where the money is. Well, why do people drill where they're drilling? Because that's where the gas already is. These are gassy areas, and some of that gas has come up over time. So, you know, and in Texas and even in Pennsylvania, I've heard stories about people saying, look, when I was a kid 50 years ago, you know, there'd be natural gas seeps and we could light those on fire. That's not to excuse the industry, because the other situation you can have is a poorly built well, which allows that to happen. So that's one of the – I wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal a month ago or so, and it was sort of ways to make fracking safer. And one of the things I say is you test the water before you start drilling so you know what the baseline was, because otherwise you're not going to know who caused it and you're just going to get into lawsuits.
And again, that's Russell Gold, our guest in this hour of Radio Time, senior energy reporter for the Wall Street Journal. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University has been offering graduate studies for over 50 years. Today, Westchester has over 70 graduate degree and certificate programs in business and public affairs, health, visual and performing arts, education, arts and sciences, and their new doctorate of nursing practice. With campuses in suburban Chester County, the new Center City, Philadelphia location, or online. Details at wcupa.edu/grad. Graduate education at Westchester University. Learn more. The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. Now through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows six enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and if you are just joining us, Russell Gold is our guest. Again, the senior energy reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He received the Gerald Loeb Award and was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill of a couple of years ago. And we've been talking about his new book, again, titled The Boom, How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Any questions or comments? We've been talking a lot about the industry, and you spend a lot of time talking to people who are part of the industry as well. But I'm also curious about the anti-fracking people, if I can speak broadly about people who are, frankly, very opposed to fracking and see lots of dangers, lots of energy and health concerns. Mm-hmm. Is there something they don't understand based on all the reporting that you've done?
One of the things I would love to hear more about from them is sort of, okay, if you're going to say no to fracking, what are you going to say yes to? I mean, I remember I was at an anti-fracking protest talking to people, and there was somebody who had a sign that said, no coal, no nuclear, no fracking. And I remember thinking, well, then where do we get our electricity? What's the vision? You know, what is your vision for the future? If you're going to say no to fracking, essentially right now, then you're going to say yes to coal. You can't say no to fracking and yes to renewables. The renewables are growing incredibly quickly, but not quickly enough to take up for that. So, look, I write about Carl Pope, the former head of the Sierra Club. Almost 10 years ago, he tried to sit down and come up with this big vision. We're going to say no to this, so how are we going to say yes to this? And frankly, he couldn't lead the Sierra Club in that direction. Turned out it was too tough. He lost his job, and there were some other issues. He ended up taking money from Aubrey McClendon in Chesapeake and not telling his board of directors, which is quite a big sin in this world. But you know, I do give him credit for at least thinking, how do we do this? And you know, and I've tried to have this conversation. I'd love to sit down with like a Bill McKibben who's leading 350.org and making some excellent points about climate change. Okay, well, what then is the system? How do you support all the energy that we use as a world?
You mentioned climate change, and there have been some reports this year about, pretty serious and, frankly, some scary reports about seeing the impacts of climate change, trying to sort of wake the world up and certainly wake this country up to the potential dangers of climate change, which already seem kind of baked into the system.
Right.
But as you say in this book, fracking has sort of kept us within the sort of fossil fuel business.
Absolutely. We are in the fossil fuel business. It's hard to think through. We're still sticking in the fossil fuel business, but at the same time, we met the Kyoto protocols. This was sort of the pledges the countries were making to lower their emissions. We didn't actually technically sign up for it, but we met the goals anyway, and all these other countries that had said they would do it and did sign, they didn't meet their goals. So it's a complex problem. There is no question in my mind that renewables have got to grow as a percentage. I mean, the National Climate Assessment came out a couple days ago, and it was terrifying. And a lot of people respond to that and say, well, we need to make changes right now. Absolutely we do. But that doesn't – the energy system is probably one of the most largest complex systems in the world. It is a global system. It's not going to turn on a dime. Right. It's not going to change easily. So, you know, you sort of have to set it in a direction and wait for the change. I mean, this is one of the lessons that I took from learning so much about fracking. Well, you know, 20 years ago, the idea of fracking a shale was preposterous. I mean, you know, the textbooks would say you can't do it. And then all of a sudden, the world changed and you could do it. And it really was a combination of you had sort of government research followed by very stable government regulations and market incentives. And We have this enormous energy revolution. Well, that's sort of what we need right now to solve the climate problem. It's another intractable problem. I mean, think about it. It used to be we're always going to be importers, and we're never going to produce more oil, and we're going to need to be dependent on imported oil. Well, that's not really true anymore. We're so much less dependent than we were. From 60% of our oil being imported now down to, I think they said, 23% next year. Well, okay, intractable problem solved. Here's another intractable problem. How do you power the globe without emitting so many greenhouse gases? And once again, I think you can learn from fracking that the answer is you've got to have the government regulations put in place and then create market incentives so that all that money and the capital will sort of feed into the solutions. It can happen. It happened with fracking.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Michael from Bucks County joining us on Radio Times. And Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, you had mentioned that they were taking the wastewater into eastern Ohio, and I thought the EPA of Ohio banned that not too long ago because they had 11 earthquakes in this little town where the injection wells were. I think it's town Girard, Ohio. They had 11 earthquakes in a place that really didn't have an earthquake to speak of for many, 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 many years. And they connected it. And then I thought what happened was they were then taking the wastewater, putting it on barges in the Ohio River. As my understanding, they're trucking some of it down to New Orleans, which is huge distance. But I'll take my answer off there. I'm just curious whether that's true.
Yeah, well, let's see if we can find out. Thanks, Michael.
I don't know about the barging to New Orleans. That does seem a preposterous. I'm not saying it's wrong. It just seems like an incredibly inefficient way to do it. But you did bring up the earthquakes in Ohio. And yeah, the Ohio Department did a study, and you're talking about the earthquake cluster in Poland, Ohio. And they did connect that to fracking, and they actually prohibited fracking in that area. It's not a total ban on the entire state, but it's in that area. I mean, essentially, Ohio's approach to it, which is sensible, is that if you have any sort of earthquake activity, you have to completely stop injection wells and stop fracking until it can be studied and understood better. But, you know, look, this is an area where the EPA actually can get involved because the EPA regulates injection wells. Sometimes the states will take over and do it on behalf of the EPA, but basically it's a federal function. And we have literally hundreds of thousands of injection wells throughout the country, and they are permitted without a thought being placed to the seismic activity nearby. So maybe one of the solutions would be to say, okay, before you can permit or use an injection well, you have to do an assessment of is there an earthquake fault? Is there seismic activity? That is certainly a way to start addressing this problem. And I'm sort of cribbing here from Mark Zoback, who's a Stanford University seismologist, and he says, look, we can do this, we can do it intelligently. We just need to start saying, before we inject millions of gallons of water into the ground, we need to ask, are we injecting into an earthquake fault? Are we lubricating earthquake faults?
Michael, thanks for the call to Radio Times, which raises a whole host of questions about regulations and whether government regulators believe scientists anymore. I mean, there's a great deal of skepticism.
So.
Well, I hope so too, but there is a great deal of sort of knee-jerk skepticism about science.
That's true. There is. The way I look at it is that there's been a lot of there's been a lot of independent peer-reviewed work into this, and at least on the earthquake front, it seems that there's no question about that. On some of the other issues, how much methane is leaking, we don't really know, which is kind of scary also. Yep. There have been peer-reviewed reports that are sort of all over the place, 2%, 6%, you know. So there are some really fundamental questions. And look, we are fracking currently 100 wells a day, drilling and fracking 100 wells a day in North America. That's not going to stop anytime soon. And it really amazes me that we're 10 years into this and we're still asking these fundamental questions. How much methane is leaking and what do we do about that? It would have been nice to have tackled those questions five years ago, but this is where we are right now. I mean, that's sort of the American way, right? Drill first, ask questions later.
Yeah, but, at great peril. But is that because the industry is calling the shots? And in many ways, if you look at Pennsylvania, which, of course, had been losing its industrial base, and certainly the recession hit the state hard, and drilling Marcellus Shale offered these economic opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure the industry is calling the shots. You do certainly see it happen sometimes. But you know, the industry comes in and says, we have this great opportunity. We want to hire people. We want to provide jobs. We want to provide income. That's something that's really hard for government to turn away from and to turn down. And then the other problem you often find is that then you have the regulators, the inspectors, who are making government salaries, and the industry, when they identify someone who's good and smart or maybe even who's particularly tough, will double or triple their salary. So it's really tough to hold on to regulators, to inspectors also. So that's kind of a problem. You got to pay these guys a good wage.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And again, that's Russell Gold, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We are talking about fracking, and that's the subject of his new book called The Boom, How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I know there were efforts in this state to get more information from the industry about what the chemicals were for fracking. And that's been an area of great concern.
Yeah. Actually, I think that battle's kind of over. A couple of weeks ago, Baker Hughes, a big Houston company, one of the primary service companies that provides us, said that they would provide all the ingredients. They're not going to tell you exactly how the ingredients are mixed together, but overall, what's going into the well, they're going to provide those ingredients. A lot of pressure now on Halliburton, which is sort of the number two in that space. I think that battle's over, that there's been so much pressure, so much public insistence, physicians wanting to know so they can treat spills and exposure. It might not feel like it, but I think that the corner's been turned there and the industry is essentially going to give up the information. And, it just never made much sense anywhere. We're going to use all these chemicals, sure. We're going to inject them in the ground, but we're not going to tell you what's in them. It just never made particular sense, and I think finally the industry is going to own up to that.
You write about a guy named George Mitchell. You call him really the father of fracking, and an interesting oil man with an environmental bent, right?
Well, George Mitchell, Houston guy, goes out and becomes one of the wealthiest wildcatters, independents in Houston, and then after he's made his few million, decides he really is interested in sustainability, really interested. In these kind of questions, one of the huge funder to the National Academy of Science to study sustainability, and this is the same guy whose company Mitchell Energy pioneers and basically discovers modern fracking. He passed away last year, but before he passed away, I had dinner one night with him and one of his sons, and his son was kept asking the questions. Dad, you were so interested in sustainability. But you never invested in wind and solar.
Yeah.
You were always a
yeah.
natural gas guy, a non-renewable resource guy. And George Mitchell sort of stared off in the distance and he said, I just didn't think they were ready yet. It wasn't part of his, these are energy guys, that they will invest in where they think they get a good return. And he just didn't think wind and solar were ready. It's changed. Wind and solar clearly are ready. I mean, the price of solar has just been collapsing recently so that it's much more affordable. Wind has matured. But it's just fascinating that one of the people who was he was a liberal, green Houston oil man. You don't find many of them.
No, unusual bio, yes.
Right. But yet creates, and his company is the one that sort of creates modern fracking and unleashes it on the world.
Let me get Madeline from, looks like, Wilmington, Delaware to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Madeline. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for bringing up this conversation of fracking,
sure.
I've been trying to figure it out myself, and they're right. It is a buzzword that everyone talks about. And I think the biggest thing is that it's not that I don't I haven't really figured out whether I agree or disagree with fracking in the United States, especially in Pennsylvania. But I think the main thing is I just don't trust our government enough to regulate it. There's just so many things that I disagree with what the government's doing these days that I can't put my state in the hands of the government right now in terms of regulation. I just don't feel comfortable with it.
Well, that's an interesting comment. You made a face there, Russell Gold.
Well, I mean, here's how I look at it. If we're not getting our oil and gas from Pennsylvania, we're going to get it from somewhere. And we had been getting it from places like West Africa, Nigeria, Angola. We were preparing to import natural gas. I visited Nigeria and I've been to the Middle East. The environmental track record there is not very good, and the impact of all this oil and gas money on the community is not particularly good either. You've got very, very rich and the tiny 1% of 1% who are incredibly rich, and then everyone else who's not doing well. So I actually think that if you – I understand and I hear your distrust of government being able to do it right. But I think that the United States government, Pennsylvania, has a better shot of doing it right because you have people who are keeping an eye on it, because you have, you know, many community organizers that I've met who educate themselves. And also, you've got lawsuits. Just a couple weeks ago in Dallas, there was a $3 million verdict against an oil and gas company, not for basically being a nuisance.
That's right.
I mean, it was a nuisance claim. So this is the kind of thing that will happen in the United States. It's not going to happen in Nigeria and West Africa.
Madeline, thanks for joining us on Radio Times. About a minute before we have to say goodbye, but can you imagine a future where all the fossil fuels have dried up and gone away?
No. I think we're going to stop using fossil fuels long before they've dried up and gone away.
Really?
You know, yeah, it was the old quote from Sheikh Yamani, the former energy minister of Saudi Arabia, that said that the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones, and the oil age is not going to end because we run out of oil. No, I think we're going to find something better and use it. And renewables certainly seem like the best option right now. And electric cars, et cetera. So no, I think eventually what's going to happen is that fossil fuels will, instead of being used for everything, will have very specific use. They're great for petrochemicals, you know, making plastics. I mean, there's sort of other stuff that we're going to figure out uses for, and we'll start using less and less. Look, it's already happening. We peaked gasoline use in the United States back, in 2007 or so. And we've been going down. So it's not like we can't turn the corner. We have, actually. And it's, you know, it's efficiency. We're driving, you know, look, it can happen. And I think it's going to happen in more energy sources.
Well, Russell Gold, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, the book is called The Boom: How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. He's senior energy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moss. Thank you so much for joining us.